Welcome to the Cynic Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, back from holiday, and happy to join co-host Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind Danwei.com. How are you, Jeremy?
Very well, Kaiser. Welcome back.
Well, thanks. Joining us today is another Jeremy, Jeremy Page, and for purposes of confusion, we'll call him... Well, you will be lesser Jeremy if you'll be... No? Jeremy Page. Jeremy, we're going to call you Jimmy.
Lesser evolved Jeremy.
Right, less evolved.
Three-toed Jeremy versus more evolved Jeremy.
Anyway, Jeremy Page is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's been on the front lines reporting the biggest China story of the year, making his debut here. Welcome to Cynica, Jeremy.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
We're also joined by Cynic regular Gotti Epstein, who you've already heard wisecracking in his normal way. Correspondent for The Economist. Great to see you, Gotti.
Great to see you, Kaiser.
Glad you could make it.
And thanks for not calling me stalwart this time. you're usually your favorite term.
Right, cynical stalwart. Well, I'm really, you've forced me to say it.
Because you're not veteran yet.
Stalwart, regular, veteran sometimes.
Veteran, I've used you, veteran, okay. Anyway, today on Cynica, we're going to do something slightly different. Rather than talk about the news story itself, we're going to try to take you behind the scenes a bit and discuss how the news was reported by some of the leading news outlets. In this case, the events in question are the various pieces of the massive, sprawling, bafflingly complex, and still in many ways very opaque story that began when then Chongqing PSB chief Wang Lijun took his famous flight to the U.S. consulate in Chengdu back on, February 6th of this year. Though we didn't know it at the time, that event would lead to the startling announcement of Bo Xilai's dismissal from the Politburo in April and the announcement that same night that Bo's wife, Bo Gu Kailai, was being investigated for the murder of British citizen Neil Haywood. Gu, of course, stood trial in Hefei last week in a trial that ended just after 7 hours. We're hoping that Jeremy Page and Gotti, without, of course, giving away too many of your own trade secrets or revealing sensitive sources, you guys can talk about the challenges you faced in getting the story in the face of very stiff competition, a complex information environment, to put it mildly, very active spin by the government or even specific factions within said government, a Chinese media that was playing by decidedly different rules than The Journal or The Economist, and many actors, each with their own agenda. So I trust that this is going to be really eye-opening and of great interest to our listeners. Let me quickly just remind listeners that they can join the discussion, which I hope will be very active after this, either on the podcast page itself or on Facebook at facebook.com/CynicaPodcast, all one word. So let's just hop right in. Jeremy, what do you say? Jimmy, what do you say?
Let's go.
All right, so.
Oh, quick announcement. Cynica Week is canceled.
Oh, so. Okay, we've done away with that.
Right, we've done away with that. So very we're getting bad straight reviews. Into the meat of the podcast.
So I hope you're all happy, whiners. Okay. When did you first have an inkling, this is to both of you, that something huge was about to go down? I mean, did you have any sense that something was stirring in Chongqing, for example, when Wang Lijun was demoted? I mean, not in retrospect, but like in real time.
Right. In real time for me, it was when this blew up on Weibo and then Twitter the morning of February 7th, 8th. I think it blew up publicly on February 7th, the Tuesday morning?
Right, Tuesday morning.
Immediately I thought, despite some people thinking this is just nothing or whatever, I mean, I had a sense also from calling a couple people who wouldn't talk that this was going to be a very big deal. Wang Lijun's demotion I think I knew about it but hadn't really given much thought to it yet at that point. What are you?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think if I recall correctly, we noted that he'd been dismissed. We knew a bit about him at that stage, and we were obviously very interested in Chongqing because everything that Bo Xilai was doing there. And then I think we heard about the what was going on in Chengdu the night before, quite late on February 6th. I think that's when the first Weibo started appearing, and I think the first pictures from outside the consulate. And so we started making calls and trying to work out what was going on. And at that stage, it was nothing.
This was after midnight or around 11 o'clock?
Yeah, it was around midnight.
My home bureau office might have been asleep at that time.
So what was it like trying to actually report the goings-on at the Chengdu consulate? Were you finding yourself being stonewalled more by the Chinese side or more by the U.S. State Department? Was anybody particularly helpful?
I think they were pretty much running neck and neck with each other at that stage. I mean, we know with hindsight that the guys in the consulate, I think, were taken very much by surprise.
I can say that the non-answers were from the U.S. Embassy were helpful, actually. Okay. And in fact, almost intentionally so. And I even tweeted at that point when I finally did get the spokesman on the phone, Richard Boungon. The way he no-commented was clearly meant to actually signal that something big was going on.
And right.
So that was my first sort of on-the-record sentiment that looked like a real – that this looked like a real story.
How much did you rely on the internet in those first 12, 24 hours?
Completely in the first hours. And then I think actually it should not be understated how much Weibo and overseas Chinese sites were influential over the next weeks. I remember that day well. It was not that I remembered it at the time well, but that was the first time that something came out from somebody, a Southern Weekend editor on Weibo, which then got deleted pretty quickly, but it kind of got out there that a British man, that what Wang Jun's visit was about was...
Was about a British man, being murdered.
Now, this was in part of a maw of many rumors, and it was unclear what was true and what was not. But that started to get out at that point.
So. Let's talk about that tweet. I mean, was that went out to what? Something like it was an SMS originally that
was
sent
an SMS
from
to
a phone.
This to Chu Xiaoxin, right?
And to a number of other Southern Group and other liberal editors at newspapers. Right. Is that correct, Jeremy?
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay, and what were you? What was your assessment of the reliability of those initial reports?
I mean, initially, I think at that stage we hadn't heard from any other sources about Wang Lijun making an allegation concerning a dead British citizen. So, everything was up in the air really at that stage. We didn't have a detailed readout on what he had said inside the consulate. So there wasn't really anything to cross-reference that with at that point.
And what about the UK government? Was the foreign ministry saying anything about a British citizen who had possibly died under mysterious circumstances?
They were not at that stage, no.
Okay.
And then, over the coming days after that, that rumor played out in a different way. It sort of kept reverberating and then being twisted and... on Chinese sites, both overseas and to some extent on Weibo, although often the Weibo tweets were deleted, I would say. I mean, it's kind of hard to tell how much was.
The Chinese sites that we're talking about are?
Boshun,
Duowei.
I think Mingjing as well, and Duowei.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of it was on Duowei as much as Boshun.
I mean, maybe it's a good time to talk about those sites, because they were the source. I mean, a lot of these ex-China Chinese language sources, like Douwei and Boshin, and to a lesser extent, perhaps less credible sites like Want China Times. What has been your experience in sourcing news from any of these? I mean, are they regarded within your respective organizations as reputable sources?
Or? We would source nothing from those directly.
No, we wouldn't.
No, you do your own independent reporting. You use them as sort of tip sheets or rumor mills to sort of play off of.
But a tip sheet meaning occasionally they do have something that's
right.
Substantial.
But often have complete, bollocks, as you would say.
Right. We're going to create a glossary at the end of this, with the tip sheet.
Bollocks. but one question I'd like to ask both of you is, you say these sites are very unreliable, and I saw a fair bit of sort of patting each other on the back in the foreign correspondent community about various scoops about the whole Wang Lijun, Gu Kailai, Bo Xilai affair. And I sometimes wonder if you aren't all also being spun a line by the kind of mid-ranking Communist Party members that most people have as sources. I mean, very few people actually have access to the kings of kings, the Politburo. So isn't everybody relying on sources that are at best questionable?
Well, those of us who have access to Zhongnanhai on a daily basis don't talk about it.
Okay.
That's all I'm going to say on that. Jeremy?
Gadi is a member of the Bilderberg conspiracy. You have some special access. But Jeremy,
Yeah, I think you're right to a certain extent. Everybody here has very, very limited access. Everyone in the media business has very limited access to people even in the mid-levels of the Communist Party. Even if you did have access to someone on the Central Committee, you wouldn't be able to cross-reference what they said with two or three more members of the Central Committee. No one has sources at that level, as far as I know. But what the sort of mainstream media does do is, you know, check these things out. When you get a tip off from somebody who you believe is credible, has been reliable in the past, you do run it past other people, and you also call all of the necessary, you know, all the agencies that are involved to get their comment. And only at that stage do you actually run the story. And I'm not always convinced that some of the other organizations which have been in some cases breaking news on this, but I don't think they've gone through all those sort of checks and balances before producing the news, which explains why a lot of the other stuff that they've produced doesn't check out.
But I agree, Jeremy, in general, that there's, I would say all the reporters involved, I think, would generally agree that we don't really know the basic facts of even this quote-unquote murder. You know, there's a lot of facts that are in a black box, basically, as far as we're concerned, you know, and how exactly Neil Haywood died or why he died. I think remain a mystery, despite the official story that's out.
I think that's true. Do you mind if I just interject something at this
Please.
Point? I think earlier on in the conversation we were alluding to these first messages coming out. I think you said February 15th.
I thought that was the date that I had in my head.
I think it was March. March 15th.
So March 15th.
Yeah, as far as I recall.
Okay,
after the meetings. It was after.
It was a lot. A lot later because that would have been
someone
just
repeated
10 days,
the date to me like hours ago that it was February 15th. And
that would have been 10 days after Wang Lijun, because
so it was the Ides of March.
At the point, the point when Bo Xilai was first dismissed from his position as Chongqing party chief, we still didn't know anything about the the allegation of a dead British citizen. And then it was only because I was pretty soon after that was when I sort of learned about it and was working on the story. Oh. And then when we started to see it starting to come out on the Weibo, that's when we decided.
Right. Our internal censors here to just delete all errors that I made earlier about remembering.
Yeah, have you looking bad?
Especially when I said I remembered it very clearly.
In the lull between the whole hullabaloo in Chengdu and the actual start of the two meetings in Beijing in March. Did you have a sense that Bo was in some sort of trouble?
Sorry, in the lull between
all the hullabaloo in Chengdu and the actual beginning of the meetings, there was a lot of speculation about Bo. What was the journal thinking at that time? What kind of reporting were you doing?
Gosh, I mean, so much has happened since then. It's a bit hard to cast my mind back. But as you know, we were obviously exploring every possible angle. I think we were working on the assumption that Wang Lijun, having formerly been the police chief of Chongqing, knew an awful lot about everything that had gone down during the whole Dahe campaign,
right.
And so there would have been lots of skeletons and closets that he would have been in a position to expose. And then, you know, we knew that the relationship went back to well before Chongqing, to their time in the Northeast together. So
right. There
was all sorts so of potential things.
Long Lijun had been his police chief in Dalian,
been,
right?
Yeah. But it wasn't as I recall, until after the Lianghui that we realized that there was the death of a British citizen involved. And as I recall correctly, we were aware of that at the time that those first Weibo started coming out. I'm just sort of refreshing my memory now.
Yeah, well, I'm not. My memory is not to be trusted at this point. So.
Clearly.
So then it was. That's a sort of good example of that, where, you know, some organizations were in a position just to put this out there. We and I think some other mainstream news organizations had some legal issues to deal with, because obviously this was an extremely serious allegation that you're talking about.
Right.
And so I think quite a few organizations had to have discussions on that front.
We won't go into full. Let's skip ahead a little bit and describe, if you guys will, the atmosphere in your respective bureau at the
bureau?
Wall Street Journal. Yeah, with an X on the end.
Bureau?
With the X on the end. On the evening, in April, when the murder of Neil Haywood and Gu Kailai's arrest and Bo Xilai's dismissal from the Politburo were announced, that was a hell of a night. I mean, I stayed up till 3 a.m., I think, watching what was going on. Take us back to that night with What was it like in the news bureaus of Beijing?
I'll have to refer to Gary. I was at home. Here.
You weren't.
Yeah. I wasn't here. No,
I was at home. My home news bureau, considering it was 11 o'clock or so when
you were in your pajamas.
I did not say that.
Like
Jeremy?
A mere blogger.
Can we edit this out too? can we play music over this? I'm not going to discuss what I was wearing. I was following it closely, and I'm sure tweeting, et cetera.
I'm going to assume Gotti was wearing a black T-shirt.
We're going to have to play more music over this.
Enough of this nonsense. Tell us
I don't really have a specific recollection beyond following it closely, and then of course knowing that we'd have something to put into the into our issue that week. It wasn't a shock really at that point. I mean, Bo had been dismissed. And there was already a lot to support the reporting that Jeremy and others had done, that there was a murder, an alleged murder. And so by the time that that came out, I think the fact that Bo was suspended from the Politburo and that there were these this murder investigation was being announced wasn't, I think, I don't recall it being a kind of a suspenseful moment.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we were so surprised that Bo Xilai was suspended from his remaining party posts, but I do recall being quite surprised that they went as far as they did in the initial statement on Gu Kailai, saying that she was highly suspected of intentional homicide, which you know, within the Chinese criminal justice system is pretty much as good as declaring
it. It was seen as vindication of reporting, though, that had done by Jeremy and others. So,
Jeremy and Jamil Anderlini and others, right?
Yeah.
So Hannah Beach from Time, I don't remember, she wrote a blog post talking about how her suspicions were aroused when numerous sources that she had talked to about the Haywood murder had all the precise same stories. I mean, down to the order in which they delivered different anecdotes as though they had been coached, all told in very, very similar language. Did you guys have experiences like that when you were talking to sources? Did you feel like there had been some sort of official spin, everyone had been told, here's what you're going to say to Western reporters?
Are you talking about Chinese sources?
Yeah, Chinese sources. Specifically Chinese governmental sources.
Latterly, to a certain extent, but early on, no. I mean, I guess we had an advantage in that we were sort of, out front on the story for a while. So at that point, everything seemed to be fresh, and I believe, that the sources we were speaking to there were, we were the first media outlet that they were speaking to. Latterly, certainly there were stories that started circulating, and there was this real sort of echo chamber effect, particularly in Chongqing, where I think there were certain individuals who were repeating stuff that they'd read on the internet or telling reporters stuff that they had been authorized to tell them.
Right. Can you give us a little more color, insofar as you're able to, about what it was like to try to draw out some of these sources to talk about what was happening? What were some of these, if you can sort of reconstruct some of these conversations that you had with sources in the course of your reporting?
I can't really get into that much detail without, right, I think, giving away
just a little color,
quite a lot about who they are.
Look, just name your sources. That's where you were. It's fine. I mean, we just want to know.
You're not leaving this third floor lair. I think until we have answers.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of people who knew Haywood were extremely reluctant to talk. I think people who were either based here or coming here regularly were very concerned about being associated with him, especially after we reported the connection with Hacklett, this company founded by former British intelligence
MI6,
officers.
Yeah.
And I think anything that might implicate them even vaguely with this scandal, particularly people who are based here in the business community or other parts of the foreign community, they understood full well this was politically explosive, and there was very little upside to being identified as a friend or a former colleague of Haywood. So there was extreme caution. It was very, very difficult to get anybody to talk, even off the record.
What about Chinese sources?
pretty much the same, to an even greater extent, yeah. until it reached a point where there was so much information circulating online that there were people coming forward who either wanted to sound informed or had some sort of agenda. But you know, possibly some of them really did have insider information as well, but it became very hard to distinguish between those different types of information.
So, I mean, my whole experience as a reporter has been generally been just writing very safe technology-related things, so I've never had to report tough political news like this. I mean, what's it like? Just a general question, not even specifically related to this, but how do you assess the reliability of these sources when you're dealing with a story like this? I mean, when there's got to be intense pressure coming from your respective bureau. You've got to, you know, get this thing before the other guy. I mean, you know, look, the FT's running this. What do we have?
We have the advantage of being arrogant enough to think that we don't have competition. So we we can just pretend to be – we can just kind of do condescending analysis.
Actually, the whole world waits for the condescending to come out so you can condescend to us.
Yeah.
So, and you just put your name on the story so no one ever knows so if it's you who didn't get that.
We said it's arch.
It's arch. Highly arch. And I've worked harder to make us more arch. And I think we do benefit from being in a position – as a weekly too, that we're just
right.
We're
not, it's just publishing schedule isn't as punishing. But Jeremy, so, you must have been under the gun there, huh?
I think everybody was. I mean, certainly that it was an intensely competitive story, and so every time any media outlet, especially the more reputable ones, the ones that we know sort of go to certain lengths to check their facts or have good sources, when they came out with something. You know, it was extremely hard because this was not the kind of stuff that you could match at short notice. So a lot of the time you just had to sort of shrug your shoulders and say, hats off to them. They got that, morsel of information. We'll try and get the next one, because otherwise you might spend weeks just trying to, match the same story. And then if you're matching it 2 or 3 weeks later, no one's going to pat you on the back. So, oftentimes it's better to move on and see what you can break.
Jeremy, can I ask you a slightly critical question again I've broached before on the show about this particular story, the whole big story, which is that I think in China, one can get to the – you can't get to the inner sanctum. We are not in the next year going to find out what really happened. But in England, for example, in Bournemouth, where various disreputable British newspapers – I think the Daily Mail was the main one – had a story about Hayward touching Gu Kailai's butt in the hotel in Bournemouth. It seems to me that the more serious newspapers in Britain and America didn't take those stories very seriously. And I thought it sort of a shame that why didn't the Wall Street Journal or The Economist the Economist doesn't really do this, the Wall Street Journal or the FT or The Guardian or the New York Times send somebody to Bournemouth and really check out what happened on the stairwell of the Bournemouth Hotel, what really went down in England, where I would imagine you would have much greater access to reliable sources.
Was it just too sordid?
No, it wasn't that. It wasn't that at all. I mean, we were exploring every possible aspect of the story. I think, in our case, we're still primarily a business-focused newspaper. We have a large bureau in London, but the majority of them are focused on very different areas. We have a very limited number of people who are dealing with political and general news, and this was, political general news from another country. So, I spent a period of time in the UK, which, I don't think many other Beijing-based reporters did, and I chased as many leads there as I possibly could. But then we did reach a point where we needed to have people back here to try and work out what was going on here, what were the political ramifications of this case. So,
because Neil really Hayward, whether he touched Gu Kailai's butt or not, is not really that important.
Maybe. Not necessarily to the future of the Communist Party.
Perhaps not.
Right. And who else was supporting you, at the Journal? Who also was sort of dedicated to this story during the months of April, May?
Oh, there was a huge team, and we had people all around the world looking at it, colleagues in London, some great colleagues in New York, Steve Eder in particular, who's a legal correspondent, mm-hmm. Brian Spiegel here in the bureau. But pretty much everyone was mucking in in the early stages of the story. At various times we had people in Paris, LA, other parts of the world looking into it as well. But they couldn't be dedicated to it full time because they all have other stuff to report on. But I think you're right. You know, a lot of, in a way, Jeremy, to address your point, you know, there is a lot of stuff that happened in Bournemouth and other aspects of the, you know, what happened in the UK when Gu and Borgwagwa were living there, which have checked out actually, and they did break first in the British media and perhaps were overlooked by parts of the US media because they tend to look down on the British newspapers and assume that they're not that well sourced. But actually, you know, we looked into a couple of those things and found that they were. That they did check out, or at least parts of those stories, and they were very interesting.
I mean, some of them don't do themselves credit when they're sort of like Kung Fu Assassins, or, you know, is the headline. So, I mean.
But I think certain parts of the British press are a little bit like the overseas Chinese press, right? You know, they get it right sometimes and they break news, but.
Better wrong than boring.
Yes.
Well, I mean, talking about some of the ex-mainland China press, the Hong Kong press was breaking a few stories here on this. How do you assess their reporting on this particular story? I mean, collectively, obviously, they're not a monolith, but there were some Hong Kong-based Chinese news organizations that would break a story, and then some certain unnamed wires would kind of claim credit for a story that had already run in Hong Kong.
Well, it really depends on which one you're talking about, but, like, for instance, was it Apple Daily, I think, that was probably first with significant details on Bo's family wealth. And that was followed up with great reporting that kind of fleshed that out by both Bloomberg and the New York Times. And also the Journal FT did pieces of it, too.
I mean, that seems an obvious angle, though, to go after the Bo family wealth.
Right. So that was one. There's other media that I think have had more scurrilous stories, but I don't have a clear recollection of, like, which ones, you know, fleshed out well and which didn't. There's tons of rumors floating around out in overseas Chinese, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the U.S., and a few of them did check out and became the crux of big stories. But they have to be, you know, for us to print them in places like The Journal or certainly in The Economist, they have to be multiple sourced or, you know, have kind of been vetted by reporters who really worked the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, not to disrespect my Hong Kong colleagues, you know, I don't think the Hong Kong media has been as aggressive on this story, or maybe it's not a lack of aggression, but I don't think they've really sort of broken many of the key elements of the story. And in a way, that's surprising because there has been this, you know, quite a strong Hong Kong connection with the Bo family. Bo Guagua has spent some fair bit of time there. We know that Gu Kailai's sisters have significant business interests there. And there's still this, you know, open question about, you know, her being referred to as Bo Gu Kailai and whether that's because she might have Hong Kong residency. I think in a way that's been surprising that the Hong Kong media hasn't taken the lead more on the story, given that they do, you know, in the past they've proven themselves to have pretty good contacts up here as well.
Who would you name as some of the unsung heroes in your news organizations and in other news organizations who you think contributed sort of above and beyond the call on this story? I mean, all the way from February to August to this month.
Well, I'm going to cite other. I mean, they're not unsung so much anymore because their names have been put on stories over the last few months. But you know, one that was unsung a lot before this scandal, I think, was, you know, Jonathan Ansfield of the Times.
Absolutely,
has done a lot of terrific reporting on this. So that'd be a name I would single out.
Jeremy, anyone from you that you think sort of is more deserving of recognition?
Yeah, I think I think there's a whole bunch of people at various different news organizations. You know, Chris Buckley's been doing some great stuff.
Fabulous stuff,
at Reuters. Jonathan Ansfield and the whole team at the New York Times has been doing some great stuff. You know, the Financial Times, obviously, the Bloomberg investigative reporting has been fantastic. You know, I think there's a whole bunch of people. I think, you know, the entire press corps has obviously been focused on this, and at different times, different organizations have taken the lead on the story. It's almost been like a sort of tag team effort.
All those names are justified. I was saying that actually, most of these names aren't unsung to anybody who's really watching China closely. All of our names are unsung to people who aren't watching China closely.
Yours will forever remain unsung because you're anonymous.
Yeah, in my case too. But you know, that's what I'm referring even to. You know, Jeremy's work as well.
So this story still has not really captured the minds of people in the United States and Britain as a
I think it did at the time. I think it did at the time for a while. I mean, back in February and March, I think it attracted more attention. And by now, it's now in the U.S., it's all about Romney, Obama.
And this week was pretty hard to compete with the Olympics too, right? Gulkarnain trial right in the middle of the Olympics. Which was and it's quite assumed is planned that way.
It would take a lot, I think, to get the attention of the U.S. Electorate that are leading to November here to draw attention away from their own election.
I guess I want to
our own election
give our listeners just an even more clear sense of the kinds of obstacles and challenges that you guys face trying to do reporting on a story of this level of political sensitivity and gravity. I think that there's a lack of appreciation sometimes for just how difficult it is to clutch at anything that's valuable. Talk a little bit about that, about the challenges that you guys face as reporters here.
Well, we every week whenever we write on this particular kind of story or anything about elite politics, there's a lot of care and attention that goes into what do we really know versus what do we, what has even been reported in places like the Journal that we're not sure about, and no offense at all to what's been reported by others, but we feel more comfortable if we've confirmed stuff ourselves, of course, but also in cases where there might be an agenda at work, we don't want to assume too much about the narrative. I mean, I think this point has been made pretty well by some kind of very skeptical China watchers that the whole narrative of this Haywood case and Gu Kailai is very much a question, and you really shouldn't assume too much. Even some would say that Haywood, for instance, was murdered, at all. I mean, we don't really know a lot about this. And so
your use of air quotes every time you use the word murder.
No, we use, certainly people have said he was murdered, and you can kind of frame things in a way. There was a murder case, and Wang Lijun did go to the, we're pretty clear on what he said at the American embassy by now. And so you can put things in other people's mouths. But we're very careful about how we frame those things.
Jeremy?
Yeah, I agree in general on covering Chinese politics. It's always been that way. It's a very challenging reporting environment. And I was previously in India, and it was almost the exact opposite, where you could very easily get the mobile phone number of an Indian government minister, mm-hmm. and he would pick up and he would talk to you for 10, 15 minutes maybe about what happened in that day's cabinet meeting. But you had the opposite problem that once you'd spoken to him and you thought, great, I've got that fantastic nugget of information, you could then call another cabinet minister and get a completely different point of view. And then you could call another. And
at least you had that Rashomon thing.
But you had the access, right. And that was fantastic. Here, you obviously don't. But you have to say something. You can't just give up and not report anything. So we do our best. You get as close as you possibly can, and you cross-reference stuff, and you try and build, some sort of consensus about what people who are, close to the top think is going on. But I would disagree slightly on the Haywood case. You're right to a certain point in that, particularly in the early phases, a lot of the stuff that was coming out had all come through the mouth of Wang Lijun, and was basically the story that he'd told in the U.S. consulate, which was leaking out through various different sources as different people were briefed on it. And obviously, once he was in the hands of Chinese authorities, they had a pretty good handle on the story that he had to tell. But it all originated with him, so it was his version of what had happened. And I don't... in a lot of the reporting, I don't think that was made clear enough, that it was all coming through that prism. But I think also latterly, when there's been so much information and possibly misinformation out there, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that there is a separate strand of reporting from friends of Neil Haywood about his relationship with Bo Xilai, which is completely separate from Chinese authorities.
I agree with that.
From Wang Lijun. Yeah. And that takes us actually right up, for instance, the fact that came out in the official narrative during Gu Kailai's trial, that he was summoned down to Chongqing.
Right, that he was afraid for his life.
At short notice by a representative of the Bo family. And that, you know, he went down there and checked into this hotel and was waiting for this meeting. Now, I've reported that based on, you know, conversations he'd had with friends. So that does actually sort of partially corroborate.
No, I do. And
I agree in terms of what actually happened thereafter, whether he was killed or not, we still just don't know.
Right. And I do, you know, I believe he was murdered. He definitely died under suspicious circumstances. I'm just saying that there is a wide spectrum that you could accept a wide range of possibilities.
There's reasonable doubt about pretty much everything everybody's printed about this case.
Yeah, not everything.
That's kind of my point. Is I don't think on you know the stuff relating to Hayward's background and the conversations that he was having with his friends,
I would say that take us
right up until you know the day before he died, really.
But after that, the exact circumstances of what happened in the hotel room, everything
is very difficult to set up because obviously, you know.
I say there's reasonable doubt about your statement just now, Jeremy Goldcorns.
It's reasonable three-toed doubt Jeremy. About many, many things.
Let's not get into epistemology here. But we could euphemistically describe the atmosphere in which you guys operate as a very complex information security environment. I mean, things are, you know, it must pose challenges in how you protect sources.
Is this where you mentioned a disclaimer of your employer?
No,
Kaiser.
let's talk about how you do protect sources on a sensitive story like this. What sort of extra measures you take to protect their identities and
all I can say is it's extremely difficult and getting more difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no such thing as secure telecoms here, and people who are based here are increasingly aware of that. Right. To the point where. You know, it can get very hard even to arrange a physical meeting so that you can speak face to face. Just by doing that to people who aren't supposed to be speaking to the media or could be potentially compromised, that in itself is very risky. So they just don't go there. It's a problem for a lot of media organizations. I don't think they most spend enough sort of time and money addressing the issue. I think a lot of non-media companies have been quite slow to wake up to that problem, but in the media industry, because they're less well-resourced than a lot of other businesses, it's a big problem. You know, I'm not speaking on behalf of the journal, but a lot of media organizations can't afford to hire, you know, top-tier in internet security companies to come in and check your systems on a regular basis. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, we're glad that you weren't called away on sudden notice and you were able to come in and you didn't have to rush off to Chengdu or wherever they're holding the Wang Lijun trial. But we expect that after the trial, you'll be back to talk to us about what happens there. I want to thank you all, first of all, for providing a very insightful perspective on what it's like to actually report a story like this. And I hope that was of value to our listeners. I'm going to move on to the section of the podcast where we make recommendations of something that we've read or seen, something on the internet, something preferably that you can throw a link up to, and we will do so. Okay, Jeremy, why don't you go first? What do you have to recommend for this week?
It's not specifically China-related, but it's a podcast. It's the BBC's Global News podcast, which goes out twice daily. Which I recently discovered, and it's from the World Service, not from the domestic BBC. And it's a wonderful global look at the news. It's slightly Anglo-centric, of course.
Surprise.
Surprise, it's the BBC. But you get news from Angola, from China, from Liberia, from Mogadishu, from Patagonia, any place. And it's quite in-depth. It's not just sound bites, so... for example, they did a story on Syria today where they had an interview with someone who was an expert in the arms that were being used, so could actually give you a few minutes of talking background about whether the rebels had actually shot down a Syrian government jet, etc. It's just great if you like really pretty global news.
Great. Global news. Twice daily podcast.
Twice daily.
Available on iTunes?
On iTunes.
Okay, very good. Gotti, what do you have for us?
Yeah, something to consider in the wake of the Gu Kailai trial. Not that I'm comparing her to Gu Kailai, but there was a nice piece in the Smithsonian online that I read today called the Demonization of Empress Wu.
Wu Zetian.
Yes. The Tang that, and it's a tale full of sex and violence, and is also educational at the same time. So I recommend that to our
readers, Dragon Ladies,
to our listeners.
Great. Yeah, I saw that you had posted that on Facebook, and I was going to click to it, and I realized I had to jet off, but I'll read that tonight. Jeremy, what do you have for us?
I would very much recommend a piece I read recently, a paper written by Alice Miller. It's available on the China Leadership Monitor website, which the Hoover Institution runs. Which is a great resource anyway for anyone who's interested in China leadership issues.
Alice Miller is a great resource. Yeah.
Also, Joseph Fusmith had an article in that same issue, right? That was also pretty good.
Yes, all the papers are excellent.
Talk about Alice.
This one is it actually picks apart a lot of the reporting which has been done on the Bo Xilai scandal, which is maybe not entirely in my own interests. But where she's particularly good is she analyzes in minute detail some of the official announcements, particularly on leaders' movements and leaders' appearances, as well as the language that's used in the official media, and she does that in a real sort of old school sort of Kremlinological way that not many people do these days.
Yeah, she's really the eminent Zhongnan hiologist. Tell you the Beidaihe conference is on, the Beidaihe conference is off.
Exactly, right? And she blows apart a few of the sort of myths that have sprung up around Bo Xilai and Zhou Yongkang and others in quite an informative way.
So Zhou Yongkang is not in the doghouse?
I think that if I recall correctly, she proves fairly categorically that in that period where people were saying that he had disappeared from public view, that he actually made more public appearances over the course of that 2 weeks than he had on the previous 2 weeks or something.
Great. I'm going to do something entirely frivolous for my recommendation. The China Daily Show, which has been on fire, they did this do-it-yourself dramatic sanctimonious Why I'm Leaving China flounce template. You can sort of cross out a couple of things and make your own Why I'm Leaving China letter, which seems to be all the rage these days. Everyone's doing them. Some of them are not so annoying. Some of them are incredibly so. I'm thinking of writing Why I'm Not Leaving China. Not yet, anyway. Anyway, Gotti?
I'm not leaving China because I find the air nutritious myself. I don't know what these...
Full of minerals.
Yeah.
Yeah. You need
molybdenum. You do need molybdenum and copper.
And iron.
We're carbon-based life forms, Gotti.
Yeah, but don't say that too loudly or you're going to get beaten up in front of Chaoyang Park by a bunch of so-called liberals. Gotti, thanks, man.
Thank you, Kaiser. It was fun.
Jeremy Page, great to have you on the show.
Nice to be here.
And Jeremy Goldcorn, thanks again. And we will see you folks next week on the Cynical Podcast. Take care.